really happens when you get angry? What is that emotional reaction really all about? This is a question that can be answered on many levels. First of all, there's a very primitive mechanism, a state of consciousness, that's really based on our need for survival. At this level, anger is a frustrated and constricted version of the so-called fight-or-flight response. As you may know, the fight-or-flight response was first described by physiologists back in the 1930s. It's based on the way you might have responded 100,000 or 200,000 years ago. If you were walking along a pathway and a saber-toothed cat suddenly jumped out in front of you, instantly your body and your mind would have gone into a state designed to maximize either of two possible responses, and only two. You could either fight or run away. In other words, only fight or flight were on the agenda. Your pupils get big to let in more light, your heart starts beating faster, your blood pressure rises, you start sweating, blood gets diverted away from your stomach into your legs, adrenaline and cortisol get pumped out of your adrenal glands. All of this is to help you deal with the problem in one of two ways. And this is because a saber-toothed tiger presented a life-threatening, highly challenging situation. And your system was giving you the choice of either running away as fast as you could or picking up the nearest stick and starting to fight. And very quickly you'd find out whether you were going to survive or be killed. The fight or flight response is built into our nervous system at a very deep level. Human beings never had big claws or big teeth, and we are not very fast and we don't have thick skin or scales, so the fight or flight response allowed us to survive in a very menacing environment. But saber-toothed tigers disappeared a long time ago. The fight-flight response is still here, and you still activate it very frequently, but now you're in a world where neither fighting nor running away are likely to be appropriate options for behavior. If you're driving down the highway and you're in rush hour traffic and someone cuts you off, you can't very well fight with him and you can't run away either. If you're in a grocery line and somebody ahead of you leaves their shopping cart and goes back to look for a few more items, you can neither fight nor flee. Or if your son comes home and shows you a D on his algebra test, you can't hit him over the head with a club. Or if your boss comes in and says a report needs to be back on his desk in 10 minutes, you can't run away because you need the paycheck in order to pay your bills. But the biology of the fight-or-flight response has still remained intact, even though the behavior options have radically changed. So what do? Most of the time in fight-or-flight situations, we just get angry, even though we might not show it. There might not be a real argument, but we just become very angry and hostile and interrogating and intimidating and say hurtful things instead of actually throwing rocks or running back into a cave. Or we may just shut down. We may say, fine, if you're going to be that way, I'm not going to talk to you. There are many ways of showing anger, but they're basically adaptations of the fight-or-flight response. There's a lot of stress involved in creating these adaptations, and that contributes to anger also. Even the coping mechanisms that turn fight or flight into acceptable behavior have created anger as a side effect. All these feelings are held inside, but they really need somewhere to go. For our society, this is becoming more of a concern every day. We have a whole new generation of kids who fight battles with the universe in video games, and they do it just by moving a finger. Yet their bodies have powerful hormones coursing through them, and 500 years ago they would have been running a mile at full speed. So to achieve real spiritual growth, to say nothing of plain everyday happiness, you've got to find a better way of processing the fight or flight response. Just turning it into anger won't work over the course of a lifetime. One alternative to anger is to do something very physical, because when our bodies are in vigorous action, our emotions no longer occupy center stage. Supposing I'm driving down the highway and I'm late for an appointment, so I'm going a little over the speed limit, and the highway patrol catches me and I look in the rearview mirror and I see the flashing light. my fight or flight response is instantly activated. I'm sweating, my heart's beating faster, my blood pressure is rising. My body is saying, get out of here, get out of here. But what do I really do? I pull over to the side of the road, put on a sheepish smile on my face. I've taken the whole activation and suppressed it, and I'm angry. In that kind of situation, I believe doing something vigorous and physical is really essential to releasing the emotion. It doesn't have to take more than a minute or two, but it has to be something physical. You have to process the fight or flight response on the physical level. So you should just pound the steering wheel for a minute. Or if you're at home, you can shout into a pillow. Go to the ocean and throw some rocks. Just do something. Get on your exercise bike and work out for a while. When you're dealing with very primitive instincts, the most effective response can also be primitive. And the result will be a lowering of your anger level, because anger only comes into play when other alternatives aren't put into action. We've seen that anger has some very deep-seated roots in human development. Now let's consider some of the effects of anger as well as its origins. For the sake of clarity, I'll begin by talking about anger in its really extreme form. Most people don't reach this peak of anger very often, and later we'll look at anger in its more suppressed manifestations. But for now, we'll focus on the effects of a no-holds-barred, fully developed outburst of anger. For example, what do you look like when you're furiously angry? It varies from person to person. Some people turn red as blood rushes to their face. Other people lose their color. Their faces turn pale. When someone is described as livid, this is what's being described. Livid means gray and ashen. Some people yell and scream when they're angry. Others become quiet and sullen. Anger can cause you to stomp around the room, to throw things, to jump up and down, to physically hurt those you love, and to perform many other actions that you later regret. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that anger in an extreme form is like an attack of insanity. It's literally a departure from our senses. In fact, I think that's not even going far enough, because furious anger is a kind of temporary reversal of the evolutionary process, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Like a werewolf on the night of a full moon, a really angry person turns into a different kind of being when a hungry shark sees a fish. It doesn't have any thoughts except eat. When an angry person confronts the object of his anger, only the most primitive impulses occupy his brain. He's past the point of seeing things from more than one point of view. He just wants to wreak havoc on whomever or whatever has brought him to this point. When I say this is a reversal of the evolutionary process, I'm referring to a point I made earlier in the program when we were discussing intention. I believe that the universe as a whole, and human beings in particular, are evolving in a particular direction. The human race is moving toward enlightenment, toward greater understanding, toward unity with spirit. And I believe one of the great purposes of our lives is to further this process. Anger, quite simply, is a step in the wrong direction. Anger is a step backwards from enlightenment, a step backwards towards a survival-based mode of existence in which might is right and winning is everything. Let me be a bit more specific about this, because I believe it's a very important point. Once you understand how destructive anger is to synchronicity, you'll see why it's so important to bring this most common form of emotional turbulence under control. You see, the ultimate goal of spiritual transformation is unity consciousness. A truly enlightened person recognizes the essential unity of himself or herself with other people and with the whole universe as a whole. The awareness of an enlightened person is on what he or she shares with other people. Enlightenment moves us to help other people, even people who are strangers, while anger moves us to harm people, even those we love. The enlightened person recognizes the universe as his or her extended body. So the direction of enlightenment is toward unity, but the direction of anger is toward isolation. Enlightenment desires oneness, while anger promotes separation. At the very beginning of the program, I mentioned there are only two signs of growing enlightenment. There are only two ways of knowing for sure that your consciousness is moving towards spiritual transformation. One sign is that your worries begin to fall away. You just stop worrying about things. The other way is that meaningful coincidences start happening in your life. Synchronicity becomes a bigger part of your daily experience. And when you combine those two signs with intention, you're beginning to use synchrodestiny. If you think about what I've just said, you'll realize that it's impossible to imagine a very angry person experiencing any of that. An angry person can't possibly focus his awareness and intention on the synchronicities in his life because he's too preoccupied with his anger. Anger won't let you think about anything else any more than a shark can think about anything except eating and swimming. So if the presence of synchronicity in your life is a symptom or sign of evolution, anger is a good way of making sure that that sign gets erased. Because for the duration of its presence, extreme anger evolves you backwards toward a lower form of consciousness. So there's no doubt about it. In terms of synchronicity and synchrodestiny, anger is a very destructive form of emotional turbulence. Yet anger is probably the most common form of turbulence, at least in adults. For children, the most common form is fear, but we can't make a really sharp distinction between these two feelings. Fear is always an underlying element of anger, just as our childhood continues to influence us, no matter what our age. Here's a simple example of what I mean. A little boy wakes up in the middle of the night and calls out in fear to his mother that there's a monster in his bedroom. His mother calls back that it's not a monster, it's just his coat hanging over the back of a chair. Now the little boy is not only frightened, he's angry too. He demands that his mother come into his room to get rid of the monster. But his mother has fears of her own. The same thing has happened before, but when she's gone into her son's room to comfort him, it only seems to ensure that he'll call out to her again on the following night. So she stays where she is, and she tells her son to turn on the light in his room so that he can see the coat hanging on the chair. But of course he's afraid to get up to turn on the light, because the monster might eat him. So there they are, both of them are frightened in their different ways, and both of them are also angry. What has to change in this situation? There are many short-term solutions that may occur to you, but the fundamental remedy is for the little boy to grow up. Then he'll know the difference between a coat and a monster, and then he won't be afraid to get up and turn on the light. But there's also an excellent chance that this incident and many others like it that take place in almost everyone's childhood will leave a small but indelible impression of fear and anger, not only in the boy's brain, but in his emotional and spiritual self as well. Because there was some pain here that wasn't digested. The little boy may have eventually fallen asleep and then forgotten about it the next day, but another experience of unprocessed fear and anger will have taken place. A man I met recently makes me think of what a boy such as this might be like 20 or 30 years later. This was a friend whom I hadn't seen for several months. "So how are you?" I asked him. He said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I'm really very angry. My supervisor at work is taking credit for a project that I put together, and at the end of the year, he's the one who's going to get a big cash bonus. I won't get the recognition I deserve, and I won't get any money either." And he just looked at me with the expression of an injured child. "Maybe you could find a way of telling your side of the story to someone higher up," I said. He looked at me in total amazement and said, "I couldn't do that in a million years." At the risk of sounding even more naive, I asked him why not. "Because I'm afraid," he said very frankly, "if my supervisor ever found out I had done that, he'd get me fired." And he was just as certain of this as a little boy who knows the monster will eat him if he gets up to turn on the light. Even so, I felt like this had been a good conversation for my friend, who was definitely a person who was preoccupied with angry emotional turbulence. We had just met for the first time in weeks. It was a beautiful day. There may have been many interesting synchronicities taking place in his life, but he was oblivious of everything but his anger. The good thing was that he had at least gone from just saying he was angry to admitting he was afraid to do something about it. He'd come closer to realizing the essential childishness of his angry feelings. The idea that fear and anger arise from patterns formed in childhood is not new, and it can be easily misunderstood. We might ask, for example, whether it's better to express our anger or to keep it aside. Based on the fact that anger is really a form of accumulated emotional turbulence, it might seem like getting it out is better than holding it. But in terms of spiritual development and even personal safety, simply releasing anger can do much more harm than good, because getting really angry just makes us angrier. Anger is not like a balloon, which deflates when the air is let out. It's more like gasoline. Once it's ignited, the worst thing you can do is add more of it. You should not fuel your anger by simply venting it, and you should also deal with angry feelings as soon as possible after their inception. But since anger and fear have their origins in childhood, it's unlikely that most people have the maturity to process anger at the starting point. The regression exercise that we are going to do now is designed to put you in touch with the experience of being angry as a child. It may help you get rid of anger that arose out of a specific situation. But its real purpose is to help you remember what it felt like to be enveloped by incomprehensible anger. The exercise takes about 10 minutes, so choose a setting where you're not likely to be interrupted. As usual, we'll begin with a brief meditation. So just bring your attention onto your breathing, or silently repeat a mantra if you prefer. Now think back to yesterday. Imagine that your memory is a video cassette that you can rewind to any time you choose. Right now, take it back just 24 hours. What were some of the things you did during the day? Was there anything that frightened you or made you angry? It doesn't have to be anything specially important or dramatic. Just an event that shifted your awareness toward fear or anger. You may have felt impatient waiting in line somewhere, or someone may have spoken rudely or inconsiderately to you. For the next 60 seconds, try to remember the events of the day in as much detail as you can. And as you focus on a moment of anger, become aware of the sensation in your body as well as in your thoughts. Now rewind your imaginary video further back. Think back exactly 1 year. Try to recall what you were doing a year ago on this date, or as close to it as you can remember. What was in your mind at that time? Do you recall being worried or angry about anything? Try to feel the sensation in your physical self. Does it feel the same as when you thought of how you felt just yesterday? Is it less intense or more so? Now go back to when you were a teenager. Again, focus on a situation that made you angry or frightened. Feel the sensation. Relive what you felt both physically and emotionally. Can you see how the anger that you've experienced recently has been built on emotions that came much earlier? Allow yourself to recall this feeling for the next minute. Now see if you can remember even further back. Rewind your imaginary tape once again. Remember when you were a child or even a toddler if you can. What's the earliest time in your life that you can recall being angry? Call that experience up in your mind. Where were you when it happened? Who else was there? Who or what was it that made you so angry? Feel the sensation. Feel it as vividly and as powerfully as you can over the next 60 seconds. Now we are about to begin the most important part of this exercise. We've seen how feelings of anger and fear have accumulated over the years. We've seen how every day provides new occasions for hostility and emotional turbulence. But there was a time before any of this took place. In your mother's womb, you inhabited an environment of nearly perfect bliss. Although a lot of people cannot consciously remember what life was like before birth, the memory of that experience still exists in every cell of your body. It's a memory of utter peace and tranquility. There was neither past nor future. There was no sense of separation from your surroundings. So there was no ego or ego-driven desires. There was nothing to be afraid of. So there was no possibility of getting angry either. In your imagination, try to visualize what that experience of bliss might have been like. Focus on this experience for the next minute. Rewind the tape of your memory until the screen goes black and feel the boundaries evaporate between yourself and your surroundings. For the next minute, feel the total loss of all your accumulated anger, fear, and ego. Now, with that experience of total bliss still occupying your consciousness, begin to move your video cassette forward again. Visit the points in time we envisioned earlier, the angry and fearful moments from your childhood, from your teenage years, from 1 year ago, from yesterday. As you envision these scenes, introduce the experience of prenatal bliss into the setting. Instead of allowing one moment of anger to build on another, begin to erase these moments one by one, from earliest childhood to just yesterday. Spend the next minute feeling the fear and anger being rendered invisible by this memory of perfect oneness. Just as the images on a video cassette can be erased, allow the toxic feelings of many years to be erased by the oneness with spirit that is your original and authentic self. Please open your eyes. I hope it's clear that the exercise we've just completed is something very different from simply letting your anger out. Instead, it erases anger as if the feeling were a message written in disappearing ink. You can use this videotape technique at any point during the day or in the evening just before you go to sleep. It's really an excellent method for attacking the problem of anger at its deepest roots. This session is about the paradox of anger, and by now you must be wondering what's so paradoxical about it. A paradox, after all, is an apparent contradiction. When two ideas seem to be mutually exclusive but really aren't, that's a paradox. Quantum physics is full of paradoxes. The idea that a subatomic particle can be in two places at the same time, for example, or the idea that light can be both a particle and a wave. But what have we said so far about anger that's paradoxical? We've said that anger has its roots in fear, but this doesn't seem to be contradictory. It's just an insight that looks beneath the surface of an emotion. The paradox of anger lies in the fact that everything I've said may be true, but its opposite may also be true. I've said that anger is based on fear, and I believe that, but anger is also based on hope. If you're really without hope, you're not going to be angry. If you have no hope in a relationship, you're not going to be angry at your partner. If you're totally resigned to never getting anywhere in your work, you're not going to be angry at your boss. When people who are sick have totally given up hope of getting well, they no longer feel angry about what's happened to them. They move to another dimension of emotion. I once was visiting a zoo where a monkey stood on the other side of a plate of glass and made faces at me. I didn't feel the least bit angry or insulted. Yet if a human being had mocked me like that, I would probably have felt irritated. Even if it was someone I didn't know and didn't care about, I would have still been annoyed, because I have certain hopes or expectations about how people should behave. But I have no hope for an animal's behavior, so there wasn't the slightest anger on my part. In fact, the whole situation was very funny. I thought so, and maybe the monkey did too. We can express the paradox of anger like this. Anger is built on fear, and because of this, it's an extremely destructive emotion. It isolates us and moves us in the opposite direction of spiritual evolution. But at the same time, anger is also built on hope. It involves us with other people because it indicates a genuine investment in them. Rather than being eradicated, anger needs to be reconfigured and built upon in a positive way, because it actually contains a seed of real affection and even of love. From this point of view, anger can be understood as a kind of addiction. Although they are usually very self-destructive, I believe addictions derive from a craving for ecstasy, a search for deep spiritual experience. Addictive behaviors provide a false solution to this very genuine quest. In a similar way, anger is a second-rate payoff to both hope and fear. Hope and fear, after all, are really two sides to the same coin of emotional turbulence. If you can manage those underlying emotions, the secondary problem of anger will take care of itself. If you're like most people, there's an excellent chance that you're angry about something right now. You may be very angry, acutely so, to the point where your anger is taking up a great deal of space in your thoughts, but it's more likely that you've just got a kind of residual anger, anger that has built up as a result of many experiences over many years. Fear is certainly at the foundation of that anger, and hope probably is too. Neither of those feelings may be apparent, just as the foundation of a building can't be seen beneath the ground, but I can assure you that they're there. The exercise we'll do now to close this session is intended to create balance at a core level of your being. It doesn't address anger specifically because its effect takes place at a much deeper part of your consciousness. It takes place at the level of spirit, and it's designed to nurture what I call ever-present witnessing awareness. The exercise takes about 5 minutes to perform. Unlike our previous exercises, this time I'd like you to keep your eyes open, but in soft focus. You can gaze straight ahead, but without looking at anything in particular. As you do so, just listen to what I say with an open mind and heart. Now listen to what I say, simply, without judging or without intellectualizing. Spirit is ever-present witnessing awareness. Sights and sounds float by in my environment. Thoughts float by in my mind. Feelings and sensations float by in my body. Only the ever-present awareness in which these come and go remains. This ever-present witnessing awareness is me. Simply be aware of what is already happening and rest in the awareness of what is. Allow all things to come and go, not attached, not pushing, not rejecting, just allowing. Past and future are experienced in ever-present witnessing awareness. When the past occurred, it occurred in the ever-present now. When the future occurs, it will occur in the ever-present now. There is only the ever-present now, timeless and eternal. There is only this ever-present present. There is only right now. Past and future are in the imagination. Events float by. Time floats by. I am always now, timeless and eternal. I cannot enter now the timeless and eternal because it is always present. I cannot start witnessing. I can only notice that this witnessing is already happening. It is always there, and it is always now. This awareness never began in time because it is ever present. I am the ever-present witness in which the cosmos arises now. All suffering stems from separation, the self-image, the individual body-mind trapped in space and time. You can't go looking for the looker. The seer is the one who sees, and you can't go searching for the one who is searching. Although I experience different states of awareness, I am not those different states of awareness. I am the ever-present witness of those states of awareness. I am the seer of those different states of awareness. Just acknowledge the ever-present witness. This witness is spirit. Spirit is not difficult to find. In fact, it is impossible to avoid. It is this ever-present eternal witnessing that is already happening. Even into the endless future, ever-present awareness will simply be present. There is no place where spirit is not. Spirit is available to us now, fully, totally, completely. Be choicelessly aware now, this moment. Don't try to run away from the now, because you cannot. Now is ever present. Stay in this choiceless awareness now. Remain with soft eyes, still not focusing on anything in particular. Now be aware of everything in this room. Be aware of the spaces between thoughts. Be aware of the spaces between breaths. Be aware of the spaces between the objects in this room. Spirit is in all these spaces and in the objects in these spaces as well. In fact, Spirit is ever-present witnessing and we cannot avoid it. It is in you, above you, beneath you, beside you, all around you.